Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good evening, Jim Potts back on the air. How's everybody doing out there, and welcome back. Last week we ended with talking about the preventing school shootings, and that's where we left off last week. We talked about we kind of finalized it with attackers talk about their plans, and we went through some things, and we're going to continue with that piece for a moment here. But after that, we're going to be talking about workplace violence and how to prevent that. So let's get started. But before I do that, I also want to talk about some emails that we received. One person asked me from Paul from Minnesota, asked me when I was talking about wage and hour, he didn't know what wage and hour was. So let me just explain. Wage and hour has to do with whether or not a person is being either paid correctly, they're getting their lunches, their breaks, etc. That all comes under what they call the wage and hour laws. So as a result of that, if an employer fails to pay somebody, the wage and hour laws would kick in. So breaks, overtime, lunches, wasn't paid their compensation when they left, etc. So, Paul, that all has to do with wage and hour, and that gives you a slight overview. So I wanted to at least answer that question for you. I also got an email where the caller mentioned, the email person, it looks like Michelle from the San Francisco area apparently, wanted to ask me about automatic weapons, because one of the callers that came in last week from New Jersey, I was talking about automatic weapons. And she's saying, well, I really don't know anything about guns. Could you explain what is an automatic gun? Well, let me just tell you, they're firearms that are automatically load one round, which is a bullet. And after the first one has been fired, the next one comes right in. So it's really one right behind each other, which if you think about the Las Vegas shooter, that's what he was doing. He was using an automatic weapon and was constantly firing. Now, these type of weapons continue to fire if the trigger is pressed and held. They can fire between 500 and 1,500 rounds per minute. And that's an awful lot of firepower. So at any rate, Michelle, there it is. That gives you a rough idea. I'm sure there's more information that's available to you on the Internet as well. Next email that I received asked me whether or not I heard about the eighth graders who were given, if you're ready for this one, body shields at their graduation because they're getting ready to go to high school, and they're asking me, you know, what do I think about that? Well, it's true. There is a school in Pennsylvania. It was a St. Cornelius Catholic school, and at the graduation, these kids were, in fact, given body shields because they're getting ready to go to high school. And it's interesting that they would do that. I don't know if it's a sign of the times. They certainly didn't do it as a joke because these shields cost about $150 each. So there was some expense associated with it. And what is my opinion? Well, I don't want to say that's a little over the top because people are so concerned. And I guess people have to do what they have to do for what they think is going to be safe for them. So I say good for them. They spent the money. It's to help protect these children. They're getting ready to go to high school. So I don't really have a problem with that. I think anything that we can do to protect the children is what's important. All right. Now, having said that, let's pick it back up from where we were last week. Now, although some attackers, they make threats, most don't threaten targets directly. There's research out there that says it's helpful to distinguish between making threats, which is simply telling people they intend to harm someone, and posing a threat. So making a threat versus posing a threat. Posing a threat has to do with engaging in behaviors that indicate intent, planning, or preparation for an attack. All right, so those are what the differences are. Because some people make threats, but it doesn't mean anything. They're empty threats. And these days, I know, how can we really tell? Well, we can't. So that's why we need to investigate each threat at the school level. If a student makes it, a former student makes the threat, we definitely need to follow up on it, and we need to let the local authorities know. I know that's what happened down at the Parkland shooting this individual had given signs of this, and apparently the FBI didn't follow up on it, et cetera. But hopefully those days are behind us, and now people will take these kind of things a little bit more aggressively. I know that there's a lot of calls to go into the different law enforcement agencies. They're trying to do the best they can with it to sort out, you know, what's real and what's unreal. But, you know, we have to help them as well, as I mentioned on the show last time. Now, let me tell you something. Attackers, they make their plans. They make plans. This incidence of targeted violence at schools are really rarely impulsive. That's what I want you to understand. It wasn't like somebody all of a sudden just did it. It doesn't work that way. In almost all incidents, the attacker developed the idea to harm the target before the attack. In many cases, the attacker actually formulated the idea for the attack at least 2 weeks in advance and planned out the incident. Let's go back to the last one in Parkland. Well, we know that he planned it out because of the fact that what he did with the fire alarms, and he had been there as a student at that particular school. Now, targeted violence is typically the end result of an understandable, often discernible process of thinking and behavior. For more than half of the attackers, the motive was revenge. Revenge. In several cases, students made effort to acquire firearms, often from their own home, or bomb-making equipment, and solicited the assistance of friends to do so. So once again, there's people that know. These individuals have tipped their hand. It's how serious we take it, the school administrators, the teachers, friends, families, relatives. We have to start taking these things serious. Now, because information about intent and planning was potentially knowledgeable before the incident, there are some findings that suggest that some violent events may have been preventable. Well, I think that, you know, after the fact, we've seen some of that already. Quick efforts to inquire and intervene are extremely important because the time span may be short between the attacker's decision to attack and the actual incident itself. So, an inquiry should include investigation and attention to grievances and bad feelings a student may be experienced about school or potential targets. Once again, we need to make sure that the teachers, administrators, other staff members, that people are listening to these things. You know, it's easy to say that after the fact. I get it. It's like Monday morning quarterbacking. But the realities are we have to start paying closer attention. And let me just tell you something else before I forget. There's no stereotype or profile of who a school shooter may be. No stereotype, no profile. There's no accurate or useful profile of a school shooter. The personality and social characteristics of the shooters varied substantially in all of these different shootings that you've heard about. They came from a variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds and varied in age from 11 to 21. That's a lot. That's a big span, 11 to 21. And yes, an 11-year-old is just as capable as anybody else. I think there was an incident in Utah where after the shooting in Parkland, Florida, where a student, and he was young like that, he was in that age group, had planted a bomb, and some of his friends brought attention to it, and the authorities were actually able to intercept that situation before it reached a horrific situation. But he was closer to the 11 years of age. Now, family situations range. You know, getting back into no profile or stereotypes, the family situations range from intact families to foster homes. Academic performance range from excellent to failing. Few had been diagnosed with any mental disorder prior to the incidents, and less than one-third had histories of drug or alcohol abuse. So listen to this profile. I mean, so far, what do we have here? This could be any student, any age, for any reason at this point. Now, so what do we say? Research has shown that profiling is not effective for identifying students who may pose a risk for targeted violence at school. And listen, knowing that an individual shares characteristics, features, or traits with prior school shooters does not advance the appraisal of risk. The use of profiles carry a risk of over-identification, and the vast majority of students who fit any given profile will not actually pose a risk. So we don't want you out there being, you know, paranoid, you know, because if you think that they fit into that category. Now, the use of these stereotypes will fail to identify some students who do, in fact, pose a risk of violence, but who share very few characteristics with prior attackers. If you go back in history and you look at some of these, just do some Googling out there, you'll see that this is substantiated by the information that's available to the internet. Some of this information is very easy to acquire. Some of the information I have, as I told you, I can get it from secure sites, but some of this basic information that's out there, you can find. Now, consider this. A fact-based approach may be more productive in preventing school shootings than a trait-based approach. They've done studies that indicate that an inquiry based on a student's behaviors and communications will be more productive than attempts to determine risk by attending to students' characteristics or traits. So, what are we talking about? Listen. We need to listen to what these students are saying. They will telegraph. They will put the message out there. And you know, it's even more frustrating to them because of the fact that when they do have communications and people aren't listening, especially adults and family, that's even more frustrating from them, from what I understand. Now, I want you to also understand that the aim should be to determine if students appear to be planning or preparing for an attack. If so, how far along are the plans, and when or where would intervention be possible? That's what we have to think about. So, a fact-based approach is much better than a trait approach. Because, once again, you can't always tell. The range is out there, as I said, between 11 and 21. It seems like it comes from all walks of life, no matter the lifestyle, etc., and even from an academic standpoint, where somebody may be a 4.0 student and somebody else may be a student that's in the C category or under even. So listen, parents that are listening to me, listen to your children, listen to what they're saying. Make sure that you're looking on the internet to see what sites they're visiting. There was down in Orange County, there was a situation, I think I may have mentioned this maybe in the first time, but just to reiterate it, where a father in fact found out that his 14-year-old daughter was planning something that would have been worse than Columbine, but he was proactive in the matter and he found out. That's what we need to do. All right. Now, I'll tell you the other problem. And I don't think that this is, you know, such startling news, but attackers had easy access to guns. These kids have access to guns. Most attackers had used guns previously and had access to guns. In nearly two-thirds of the incidents, the attackers obtained the guns using it in the attack from their own home or relative. In some cases, the guns were gifts from the students' parents. So when we start talking about gun control, and I'm not really trying to get into a heavy discussion regarding gun control and, you know, all these things that the politicians are fighting over, you know, when there's an incident that takes place. And think about that. These other shootings were how long ago? And now the issue about guns and gun control, think about it. That's off the air now. That's how it is. That's the problem. They're not even discussing it now. They're talking about immigration because why? From the media standpoint, that's the newest issue. So that's what everybody will talk about. They won't have another discussion on this, and I can't swear to this. It's just an opinion. But if you think about what I'm telling you, they won't have another discussion on this until there's another shooting. And then all of a sudden, now that they're back to talking about, you know, guns and gun controls. And again, that's not to say that some politician out there still isn't working very hard behind the scenes. The media, you know, they share what they want to share, and that's really the bottom line. And, you know, they're going to always go to the hot button topic. But we need to be speaking out on this. We need to make sure that these politicians are staying focused on this as an issue. Now, you know, when we're trying to find out about these guns and what students have and don't have, a threat assessment inquiry should include investigation of weapons, their access to it, and the use and attention to communication about weapons. The large number of attackers who acquire their guns from home highlights the need to consider these issues of safe gun storage. Why not have safe gun storage? Why not have locks on there? I have to tell you, I'm a gun owner, but all of mine are in a gun safe. People that have guns, when I was a police officer, what did we do? We had our guns under lock and key when they were not used for on duty. And you can get these safeguards that you can put on some of these weapons that has a key to it, so these young children can't have access to the weapon as well. there's a lot that parents should be doing that they're probably not doing as well. Now, I'm not blaming every parent out there, because they always think sometimes it's not their children, you know, that would do something like this. But you got to get your head out of the sand, parents, because the realities are anybody might be capable of doing this in a given circumstance, because we've already seen that. So wake up. Wake up. Now, I will tell you that the school staff are actually often the first responders. Most shooting incidents were not resolved by law enforcement intervention. Think about it. Some of these were that the students, Parkland, let's go back to that one, you know, as an example, or the one down in Texas that was not too long ago. Those were all interrupted, actually, by the school staffers. So kudos out there to the teachers and staffs at these different schools that just don't all run, duck, and hide, where they try to do something a little bit more aggressive to try to end the incident itself. More than half of the attacks ended before law enforcement responded to the scene, despite law enforcement's often prompt response. So I'm not taking anything from them. You know, law enforcement tries very hard with this. You know, they're on patrol all over the city. The call goes out. You know, they want to set up, you know, to come in, you know, collectively. So that sometimes takes a little bit of time. Some of the agencies are a little bit more quicker because maybe, you know, it's a smaller town, et cetera. Now, I can tell you, in these cases, according to the research, the faculty and fellow students actually stopped the attacker, or the attacker either stopped shooting on his own or committed suicide. But listen to this. Many of the incidents research has shown has only lasted 20 minutes or less. And I'll give you another little tidbit here. Attackers are sometimes encouraged by others. In many cases, other students were involved in some capacity. The attackers acted alone in at least two-thirds of the case. However, in almost half the cases, friends or fellow students influenced or encouraged the attack. So that's out there, and that's why I say that, look, the word is out there. People are just not speaking up in a timely fashion. You know, kids, you know how it is. Kids are kids. Kids are in school. Kids do things and say things. We can't ignore that anymore. We have to react to it. And this business about bullying in the school, in the schools, people telling kids to do things to other people, this is real as well. And this is what leads to some of this. So we've got to be more proactive. You know, advanced knowledge among students about the planned incidents contradicts the assumptions that the shooters are loners or they just snap. Research has suggested an inquiry should not only include efforts to gather information from a student's friend and schoolmates, but also give attention to the influence that a student's friends or peers may have on intent, planning, and preparation. And I will tell you, I kind of alluded to this a moment ago, but bullying can be a factor. In a number of cases, bullying played a key role in a decision to attack. A number of attackers had experienced bullying and harassment that were longstanding and severe. What are we doing about that? We've seen it on the internet, where children have actually committed suicide because of things that happened at school and they were bullied and the parents did not listen. The school did not hear, you know, what the person was saying. And now the person takes their own young life. And that's tragic. That is tragic. So we need to start listening to that and paying attention to this business about bullying. And bullying is, you know, as many of you know now, has also now crept into the workplace as well. And I'll be talking about workplaces, you know, in a little bit. By the way, if anybody wants to call in, I don't want to forget, you know, you can call us at 818-602-4929, 818-602-4929, or you can email us at listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. All right, listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. Some people do send in emails, they're kind of shy about calling in, so that's fine. Now, let's talk about warning signs real quick as we get ready to wrap this up. Most attackers engage in some behavior prior to the incident that caused concern or indicated a need for help. In more than half of the cases, the attacker's behavior caught the attention of more than one person. Behaviors that led others, and this, you know, as an example, I'm talking about school officials or police or fellow students, all right, to be concerned included those related to the attack, such as the efforts to obtain a gun. All right. So you got to pay attention to the warning signs. They are there. You just have to pay attention. And more than three-fourths of the attackers, by the way, threatened to kill themselves, made suicidal gestures, or tried to kill themselves before the attacks. So there it is. It's out there. What are we doing? Are we preparing? Are we listening? You've got to always put it back to the fact that, are we listening? All right? I'm getting a call right now. Let's take this caller. Hi, you're live on the air with Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. Do you have a question or comment to share?
Hi, Jim. My name's Kevin. I met you a few years back, and I took your program, and we had an incident recently, and I thought it might be a good time to share it with you.
Hey, that would be fantastic, Kevin. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, we learned everything that we were supposed to learn, and I believe we did everything that we were supposed to do. We had a gentleman move into our facility, into an empty office, and it took about a day before management realized this guy didn't belong. And we asked him to leave. He left, but he left a number of things in the office that didn't add up, and some of them looked electronic. You know, we hit the red button. We evacuated, called the police, the bomb squad. Everybody came out. Local schools were evacuated or locked down. And all of our employees were out. Customers were out. And everything was kind of on cue. It turns out, in short, there was no horrible danger. And the incident basically ended. Where I wanted to bring to your attention was the stuff that I think I didn't do right.
Okay.
And, you know, I had a couple holes in my program. I needed a better way to notify management. And I could reach each one by one, but I needed a better way to broadcast to them. So we've now put in place a broadcast text that allows me to hit all of them at the same time.
Nice.
And that's proving to be great. Number two, my employees didn't take their personal belongings with them. And, you know, they didn't take their keys. They didn't take their purses. They didn't take their medications. Stuff that, you know, if we're going to be out of the building for any period of time, these are things they would have needed. We deal with a lot of cash in our business. And employees left $65,000+ in cash sitting on their desk. Little things now that, you know, that I want to make sure that they don't do in the future. Additionally, we had one little young lady in one of the safe zone utility rooms, and she's texting us, "Can I come out?" And she was over in the second story of where this issue was taking place, so I had to go back in and get her. So little things like that. Once employees are out, they need to stay out. You know, employees kept trying to go back in, even though we had a perimeter with, you know, caution tape and all of that. So communication seems to be a biggie. When you see something, say something. If it doesn't look right, it's not right. And that's being reviewed almost weekly in our safety meetings at work. And we're getting ready to rebook a refresher course with your office. So we're looking forward to getting that done.
Okay, Kevin. Well, you know, that's good to know you're going to do a refresher with this. But getting back to the incident then. So from the time that it was realized that this individual was not a regular employee, how long did it take the law enforcement to respond? Do you recall?
They were from the time that 911 was called to the time the first responders got there was about 4 minutes.
Oh, that's really good. You don't have to give me the name of the business, but what area are you in?
I'm down in Escondido.
Oh, okay.
And Escondido PD, San Diego County Sheriff's, San Diego County Bomb Squad, just a great group of people. Can't say enough about them.
You know, the act of, you know, what they say is that right now the response for law enforcement is normally somewhere between 12 and 15 minutes. For them to be there in 4 minutes, it kind of alludes to what I was just talking to a moment ago about how fast that law enforcement can respond depending on the size of the community. You know, I'm very familiar with Escondido, obviously, but that's really good time.
Our police department is really close to us, and again, we're very fortunate that they got there so quickly and it worked out as well as it did.
And how many employees are we talking about that you had to evacuate approximately?
320.
And how long would you say that it took you guys to be able to do that?
Longer than it should, because it kind of got phased in. We had it with one building and then another location, and the police kept on expanding what they wanted me to do. So I had to go reach out to this department, get them out, reach out to this department, get them out. You know, we got them out of the main area immediately, probably about 5 to 6 minutes from the time they pushed the button.
Okay. So actually ended up going in stages only because of the size of the property and the number of buildings.
That is, well, that, and it's what the police initially asked us to do, get everybody out of this building. And then it was, now get everybody out of an adjacent building. So they kept expanding the perimeter because they didn't know what was going to happen if it was an explosive device.
Got it. Got it. Well, hey, you know what? There's a good story there. It turned out all right, even though there wasn't an explosive device. I'm glad that as an organization, we were able to assist you guys in the procedures and protocols. It sounded like you did some bobbing and weaving to make sure that you got it all done the right way. And that's good because, you know what? That's what employers have to do. Businesses have to do that. You know, they need
to. You know, it was deeper than us training with the employee or with the management. You know, we do our safety meetings with the management, but I didn't find the holes in my system until we had the employees involved.
Yeah, there you go. You know, we do try to advise people when we give the active shooter training that, you know, to leave, you know, you got to leave your possessions behind. I know people want to go back and get things. But the cash that you talked about, that amount of cash, not getting into what the business is, probably should have been secured anyway. So if it's an event that something happens, then, in fact, you know, somebody wouldn't have access to that. But that's great, Kevin.
Exactly. So I just wanted to share that with you because I appreciate all of your efforts and, you know, look forward to a refresher course.
Hey, Kevin, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thanks for the call.
Have a great day, sir.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, that was Kevin. Apparently, my organization has done some work for his organization, and they had an issue that turned out pretty good when nobody was hurt, so that was phenomenal. Okay, well, look, wrapping up the piece on the schools, I just want to mention to you that a significant problem in preventing targeted violence is to determine how best to respond to students who already are known to be in trouble. This is critical. You've got to start paying attention. Some of these students are having a hard time coping in school. Sometimes maybe even the family life, you know, could be problematic for them. They're placed under all of this stress. So let's just do this. Why don't we take this one step at a time? Teachers, you're doing a great job, but let's keep our ear to the ground. Make sure that you're understanding from other students what might be going on. So it doesn't hurt to quiz some of the other students as an example or staff members. Did you hear anything? Don't make an assumption. Oh, that's just Jim. He would never do anything like that. Don't make those assumptions. All right. Let's keep a handle on this bullying, which we already know is a big deal out there. And a lot of times what we're hearing is that some of this is caused by bullying. So let's make sure that we handle that properly as well. Set up the lines of communication so that a student has a way that they can actually complain or let people know that they have a problem. A lot of the schools, from what I can see, now they may be gravitating in this direction, I'm not sure. But some of the schools that I know that we've dealt with over the last few years, they don't all have that that's in place. They make an assumption that the students are going to come to them and, you know, and let them know when they're being bullied, et cetera. That's not happening. And it probably wouldn't hurt if somehow or another the school was, you know, if they even went on Facebook and tried to do some things in terms of trying to see what students are talking about. Because some of these students, they're putting it out there on the Internet. So let's try to do a little investigation from that standpoint. Let's see what happens. You know, in closing on the school piece, I just want to say, as much as we want to make sure that none of these kids get hurt, every single situation and the facts lend themselves to a different set of circumstances. We don't know. There is no foolproof system, in my opinion. But if we can narrow it down in terms of percentage-wise, that is what the focus has to be for the time being. Because if we do that, then less students will be in a situation where they're going to get hurt. Okay, you're on live with Jim Potts right now. We're going to switch gears for a moment here, and we're going to start talking about managing threats of violence in the workplace. If you've got any comments or you want to call us, hey, do so. It's at 818-602-4929. Again, that's 818-602-4929. And I'm here for you. This is your forum as well. I want to make sure that people are going to be heard out here. I don't think our politicians are doing enough of that. That's why I'm on the air. So anything that you want to call in about and discuss that's going on out there, I'm all ears. I've got no problem with whatever you want to talk about. All right? Okay, so let's switch gears for a moment here. Let's talk about this business about managing the threats of violence in the workplace. You know, over my 38-year career, I've heard so many times where somebody has, you know, called us and said that some employee is making threats, et cetera. And, you know, at one time, let's just see what happens. But now it's reaching a point where we can't do that. You know, I can tell you with the training that we do now for businesses, with active shooter training. You got to listen to the warning signs. It's the same for the schools. It's the same for the business place as well. So it's what we want to make sure is that we are actually listening. So let me just tell you something. Workplace violence came into prominence probably in the 1990s. You know, as well-publicized mass workplace murders jolted the nation's collective consciousness. And it was with the post office. You may remember that. So out of that, what did we start saying? Oh, my God, he's going postal. Now, we remember that, but I'll bet you very few people out there even remember what the incident was that took place or whatever. We just use those words now to say, hey, the person went postal. You know, so we need to understand also. So is what I want to do is take a moment to also give you a definition of, you know, what is this violence, et cetera. Well, let me just tell you something. OSHA defines workplace violence as any act or threat of physical violence, harassment, intimidation, or other threatening, disruptive behavior that occurs at the worksite. Now, look, that includes anything from verbal threats to physical confrontations, and in some cases, homicides. And let me tell you, if you do your research on the it's online, Bureau of Labor Statistics, you'll see that there are some startling numbers out there about how many homicides actually occur in the workplace. I'm not going to get into the statistics necessary today because I do want to make sure I cover some other things. But I also want you to understand that everybody has a responsibility in any work environment to make sure that we're listening to threats, you know, that people make. And look, granted, there are different types of threats as an example. So let me just tell you also that the FBI, you know, they break down the types of workplace violence into four different categories. So now we have categories that we have to understand about this business about violence in the workplace. And the FBI has stated that violent acts by criminals who have no other connection with the workplace but enter to commit robbery or another crime. That's one type. Another type is when the violence directed at employees by customers, clients, patients, students, inmates, or others for whom an organization provides services. So now we've got two types. The third type of violence we're talking about is against coworkers, supervisors, or managers by a present or former employee. And then the fourth one is violence committed in the workplace by someone who doesn't work there, but has a personal relationship with an employee, like such as an abusive spouse or domestic partner. So those are the four categories, even when we're doing our training that we do talk about. Now, look, occasionally, threatening workplace situations can turn into serious acts of violence. I get that. You know, some people say, well, I wasn't really serious or anything. You know, in the work environment now, that's not good enough anymore. It's like being at the airport with TSA, and they ask you, do you have any weapons? You say, yeah, I got a gun, ha, 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 and you're just kidding. Hey, you'll be in handcuffs before you can get that fully out of your mouth. In the work environment now, employers are mandated. They're in situations now where they're going to have to react to this. So employers that are listening to this, just understand that you do have an obligation in this area to make sure that you take all threats in the work environment seriously. You know, making workplace violence a foreseeable risk that should be managed. You've got to manage this. You've got to have a zero tolerance policy that's put in place, period. There's nothing to talk about. If your number one employee, who's the go-getter and brings you into all this business a year, if he turns around or she turns around and pushes somebody or gets into some kind of, you know, violent confrontation with a coworker, et cetera, or maybe even a manager or supervisor, you've got to react to that. If you don't, then you face litigation. Possibly, you know, negligent retention is called. You know about it. You did nothing about it. You know, negligent supervision. You as a supervisor knew about it. Again, you didn't take any action about it. So you got to understand that. In the next show or the show after that, I'm going to have our Art Silbergel from Thompson Coburn. He's one of the top labor law attorneys out there. He's going to be interviewed on the show, and we're going to get into a little bit more about the legal aspects of what happens when there's violence in the workplace and the responsibilities that an employer has. So I'll have Art talk to you about that because of the legal ramifications, and I don't want to be giving out, you know, any type of legal advice. And I'll let Art do it because he specializes in those kinds of situations as well. You know, but the bottom line is employers are going to have to be equipped to effectively prevent, prepare for, and respond to workplace violence. And how do you start off by that? You have a zero tolerance policy in effect. You put it in writing. You pass out to all employees the policy, whether it's in the handbook, whether it's a standalone document, whatever you have to do. You put it in writing. You have them sign off on it. and you put it in a personnel file. Now, there's times when people don't want to sign things. Now, let me just say, in California, you really cannot force somebody to sign something. So we get that. It doesn't matter whether they agree with the policy. They don't want to sign the policy. It's in the handbook. They don't want to sign for the handbook. Don't worry about it. That does not negate the policy. What's important is that you have the policy. So if you have the policy, then you can do it. Now, I will tell you that, you know, with some of this with violence in the workplace, we also look to do things like our organization. And Kevin, the caller that called in, alluded to the fact that we came out there. We do site assessments. The purpose of the site assessments is to come out there and to be able to determine your strengths and weaknesses in terms of your security measures. Like the lady he said that was in the closet. Well, that's one of the things that when we do the site assessment, we tell them where the safe rooms are. So in that particular situation, her particular safe spot was a closet, and she was able to go in the closet, lock the closet, and she was able to stay in there and be safe. Those are the types of things that we do when we do site assessments. So just as an FYI. All right, now look, let's talk about employers and what their role is. Because, yes, you have a role. And it doesn't matter, by the way, the size of the business. The smaller the business, probably the less the percentages of something may happen. But don't discount that at all. There was a beauty salon down in Orange County. It was a beauty salon. And matter of fact, that gentleman is going to be coming up for trial not too long from now, I believe, in the next couple of months or so. And he, you know, engaged in violence in the workplace by killing his wife and I believe seven or eight other ladies that worked at the beauty salon. So, I mean, that wasn't a huge business, but look at what happened. Look at the number of people that got killed in that small environment. So don't think because of the fact that you don't have a business with hundreds of employees that you may be exempt from some type of violence. Because even a small business can have customers who come in and become irate. Even a small business can have disgruntled employees or current employees that might be upset about something. So it really doesn't make any difference, all right? And as in the situation down in Orange County, what happened? That had to do with domestic violence. Domestic violence is also spilling over into the work environment, all right? So now, let's talk about the employer's role, so to speak, in prevention. And I'll quote the FBI again. The FBI says employers have a legal and ethical obligation to promote a work environment free from threats and violence. It's out there now. You know, you can no longer be lackadaisical about that. It's now out there that you could be subject to litigation. So you are going to have to do what you need to do to prevent it. Now, look, as I stated about the schools, there's no way that we can guarantee that something like this is not going to happen. It's just that simple. What's important is that you prepare in the event that something does happen to be able to see if we can get the least amount of people that may be injured. So you've got to put certain things in place. Like with the clients that we do these site assessments for, et cetera, what do? We do the site assessment as an example. We also then do the workplace security plan. We also do the procedures and protocols, and we also set in place the active shooter training. So we make sure that the clients, when we leave there, have all of these things. And even with that, 100%, you can't control everything. And again, it's designed to put certain systems in place to make sure that you are in a position of creating an environment where people will not be injured or the least amount of people injured. Because there's nothing else you can do with it, all right? So you try to do something. And for those of you that are employers that are out there, you know, it's a liability issue. So you also want to make sure that you have these systems in place. And that's not to negate the fact that you do this only because you're concerned about the liability. Because we emphasize it's not just about the liability, it's about the lives of the people working for you. And most of the clients that we've had that have gone through this program, you know, it's been almost, I don't know, 80 of them now over the last 24 months or so. They all did it for the right reasons. They did it because of the fact that they were seeking to protect their employees as well. And that's really the bottom line. Because employers were nothing without our employees. You know, as a business, I'm a business owner. We can't take a day off from work unless we rely on the people that work for us. So we need to stand by them. We did a training not too long ago, and within this last week, actually, did active shooter training, and somebody afterwards, you know, walked up to me as people were leaving and said that you know, why did the employer provide this training? And I explained to them why. And the person didn't seem to believe that. The person said, nah, you know, the insurance company probably forced them to do that. I said, no, it wasn't a question of the insurance company forcing them to do it. They did it because they wanted to protect their employees, give them the information about what to do when you're out there at a mall and something happens, et cetera, because the training goes into not only what to do when you're at work, but also when you're away from work and what safety tips, you know, we were able to give them that will protect them even when they're away from work. So I'm not sure the person was 100% convinced, but that's okay. As long as you got the training, then that's it. So we have to think about preparing for workplace violence. You have to think about it. And let me tell you something. The time to start thinking about workplace violence is not when a threatening or violent situation occurs. Following such incidents, unprepared employers increasingly are accused of negligent failure to plan and prepare. It is out there. What do you think is happening in Las Vegas? I've already read the complaint that was filed by the injured people and families of injured people regarding what happened in Las Vegas. And I'm just telling you, it has to do with negligence. And they're accusing them of failing to put certain systems in place. Now, how they were supposed to second guess that somebody would be on a 32nd or 37th floor, whatever it was, you know, and shooting down on an open forum like that, you know, who's going to figure that one out? It has happened in the past because, as I think I told you in the first week, I have a lot of this history about violence in the workplace or violence out here with domestic violence and domestic terrorism because, if you remember, back in Texas at the school, they had that shooter in the tower. You know, so that was the same kind of forum as what we're talking about, what happened in Las Vegas. So, you know, people are going to sue. Now, I will tell you that, conversely, organizations that are effective in managing workplace violence risk are those that have taken the time to adequately prepare for it. Look, you have to do that. The preparation is critical. Putting on maybe once in a while these drills for people to understand if something happens, this is how we're going to handle it. It is no different than when we were in school and we were doing the fire drills. Think about it. Now, some people may turn around and say, oh, I think that's a little over the top. That's a little bit much. Okay, no problem. It could be a little bit much. But at least put procedures in place in writing that you at least are passing out to your employees. That's what I think is critical as well. All right? Now, when we start looking at the effective workplace violence risk management program, you know, what ingredients are there that are out there to do this? Well, look, Pepperdine did a study actually, and preparedness is a top characteristic of an effective crisis leader. They say that you have to do this. And when you do this and your preparation, you will find out that not only do the employees appreciate it, I can't tell you how many employees have told us that they really, in fact, appreciate the fact that that their employer actually took the time to have us and spent the money, quite frankly, because we're not free. But the fact that we came out there and did the site assessment, and then we went through the training, we provided the workplace security plans, you know, et cetera. There are people that were really grateful to us for that information. We've even had some clients where their employees have asked that could we come back out and do a training with their families. So there are people out there that are genuinely concerned. So they do appreciate when the employer takes the time and the expense to make sure that they're safe, not only in their work environment, but that they're safe when they're out and about in the general public as well. Because part of what we cover is not only when you're at work, but we cover now the malls, the restaurants, on the street, you know, in an office building, you know, movie theaters, etc. We go through all of those safety tips and also show safety tools that people can use. So, at any rate, let's keep moving on. I want to give you some strategies and prevention tips, all right? So get your pens out. You're not going to be able to copy all this down, but don't worry about it. Just do the best you can with it, okay? First of all, the first thing that you have to do is adopt a formal workplace plan, all right? A policy and prevention program, and communicate it to the employees. That's number one. Number two, have managers take an active role in employee awareness of the plan and make sure they are alert to the warning signs and know how to respond. It's the same thing for the schools. Same thing. Three, provide regular workplace violence and bullying prevention training for all employees, both new and current, and make sure you include the supervisors and managers that are in there. Number four, foster a climate of trust and respect among workers and between employees and management. Let me tell you something. That one, to me, is extremely critical. The word trust and the word respect. Respect goes a long way. A lot of times I hear about when I'm talking to clients, these individuals are suing. What is the first thing that the plaintiff wants to talk about? My supervisor didn't respect me. So that respect goes a long way. All right? So you got to foster a climate of trust and respect among the coworkers, between employees and management, and eradicate a bad culture of bullying or harassment. Now, we give training on bullying, and you know, it always comes out that, because if you look at the definition of it, it talks about tone of voice, it talks about teasing, it talks about spreading rumors, leaving others out, etc. And, you know, managers feel sometimes that they're handcuffed because the California legislators came out. Well, not just California. There's other states that have it as well in terms of, you know, bullying now. And the frustrating part for managers and supervisors is the fact that, you know, how can I properly manage my staff if I turn around and have to give them like a written warning or, you know, talk to them about coming to work late, et cetera, and now they look at me and tell me you're bullying me. Look, managers and supervisors, you still got to do your job. You still have to do your documentation, all right? Just make sure that when you're doing it for the right reasons and not the wrong reasons, all right? That's what's critical. Now, look out for and take steps to reduce negativity and stress in the workplace, which can precipitate problematic behavior, all right? The next one, identify and screen out potentially violent individuals before hiring while maintaining compliance with privacy protections and anti-discrimination laws. Now, look, on that one, I want to caution you because effective January 1st in the state of California. Now, I know I got out-of-state listeners as well, but in California now, you cannot do criminal background checks until after you've actually presented a job offer, all right? After the job offer, now you can do the criminal background check. And it's very, very sensitive. There's a lot of details with that. I don't want to go too heavy into that because of the time, but, you know, but check on the internet regarding that one. Or send me an email, and I'll explain it to you in an email. Establish and the email address, again, listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. The next one is establish procedures and avenues for employees to report threats, other violence, or if there's imminent danger. Hotlines. We have hotlines available for our clients where employees are having any kind of issues, they can call the hotline. And then we listen to it, we call them back, and we find out what's going on. And I can tell you that that is a system that works, all right? So it's a hotline number that they get to call, and that has headed off some issues, I can tell you that. You know, the next one, start a mediation program to resolve employee disputes rather than letting them simmer. You don't want coworkers at each other's throats. It's tough enough as it is, and I get it. You know, I always say that the work environment is like kindergarten. These people are at each other's throats. They bicker about everything. They complain about each other. I get all of that. But the good manager is going to turn around and help them resolve their issues. You be a referee, but don't be a judge on who's right and who's wrong. Just simply try to get it resolved. Don't look at the individuals. Look at the problem and try to get the problem resolved. And don't be biased in what you do. All right? Document any threats and your response to them, including terminate employees who make a threat. If they make a threat, and already you've done your zero tolerance policy, and you've put your handbook in place, and in there it talks about this as an issue, letting employees know that there's a zero tolerance policy in effect, and they engage in that behavior, you've got to take the action. If you don't take the action, I tell you right now, that's going to be problematic. All right? You've got to be fair, firm, consistent. Some of you out there, I know you've heard me say that in seminars. You've got to be fair with your policies, firm with your policies, and you got to be consistent with your policies. If somebody crosses the line in this area, you've got to do something. All right? Terminate employees with care and caution by involving witnesses, or if you think there's an issue that the person may be violent, make sure you have security there if need be. You know, you need to also evaluate your security systems regularly, checking, you know, the alarms, ID keys, passcodes, cameras, and personnel, etc. And make sure employees know not to hold open secure access doors for others who don't have credentials. Because people do that. We go to places and the door is supposed to be a secure door and we walk right through the door. So make sure that if it's a secure door, make sure it remains secure. And then, of course, ensure employees with restraining or protective orders against an individual, provide that person's information and photo to security or to management. Now, look, California at one time, if somebody was a victim of domestic violence, they were the victim, so they would have to get the restraining order. But California is now permitting employers to get restraining orders on behalf of the victim employee because the violence in the, could spill over into the work environment. So that's now available as well. So utilize that, okay? Okay, listen, we're running out of time, but that was the last point that I wanted to make on this issue. Again, I would encourage you, if you have any questions or comments, you can email me, as some people do, and I will try to get back to you on that as well. You can email me at listenupwithjp@possetassociates.com. All right? All right. You've been listening to Jim Potts at LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show, but let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter. All right? That's twitter.com/Jim Potts author. Again, that's twitter.com/Jim Potts author. All right? Now, look, if you become a follower of mine on Twitter, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you what we call an active shooter card, and I'll send that to you. And this is something that you should keep in your wallet. There's information on there about shooters, the characteristics of a shooter situation. It talks about how you should respond, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a small card that you can actually keep in your wallet, make photocopies, and give to your family, et cetera. Okay, next week, we're going to be talking about road rage. There are so many issues that are going on right now about road rage that we're going to be talking about that in detail. And guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to tell you what make of vehicle. I'm going to tell you the what day of the week is worse for road rage, what month is the worst for road rage. I'm going to take you through all of that, all right? So that's not a show to miss. All right. Until then, I want you to be aware, I want you to be vigilant, and I want you to be safe. Jim Potts signing off until next week.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.